Welcome, lords and ladies and squires and mistresses, to Wisecracks Show Me the Meaning. I am your master of ceremonies for today. Welcome to Camelot. This is Wisecracks Show Me the Meaning.
Show me thy meaning and honor, for that is what a knight, that is why a knight does what he does.
Are you a knight, dear sir?
We have assembled the round table of Liverpool.
Yes! Go Beatles!
Fucking,
Abbey Road, my
fucking,
favorite album. What's
you're
yours?
Fucking Scouser, mate! Fucking right! Okay, I'm Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan Haley.
What up, film fans?
And we got Raymond Kramer.
Hi, everybody. this one is off to a ripping start.
And we have gotten many requests for us to talk about The Green Knight. So we are going to be talking about The Green Knight, written and directed by one of my personal favorite contemporary American filmmakers. I'm going to call him a young filmmaker, David Lowry. He's also a phenomenal editor. I believe he edited Upstream Color. Is that right?
He did.
Yeah. Did he do Primer as well, the other Shane Carruth film, or was that
no.
all Shane?
No, no.
Okay, just
Shane,
Upstream
Shane
Color.
Shane Carruth edited Primer.
Yeah, but so David Lowry, it's starring Dev Patel, Alicia Vikander, Joel Edgerton's in there, Ralph Ineson's in there, etc., etc.
Ralph Ineson.
Ineson?
Yeah.
Yeah, fucking, I don't know my accent.
From his beautiful baritone voice, he pronounces it Ineson, but it does look like Ineson. Yeah,
okay, Ralph, let me do that one over again. Ralph Ineson's in this film, everybody. Did you know that?
Wow, he's my favorite.
He's my favorite. So we're going to be talking about this Arthurian legend, and so I guess what we'll do, let's do this. First of all, first impressions of seeing the film, I imagine we've all only seen it one time each unless somebody watched it multiple times. But also, are you familiar with this story? Are you familiar with the Arthurian legends and Camelot, and what's your history with Sword in the Stone and other adaptations? Let's talk a little bit about that, and then let's talk about the film. Let's start with Raymond.
Sure. I read Sir Gawain and the Green Knight in high school in an English class, which I think is where a lot of folks read it. I think David Lowry even said that he read it at first in his freshman year of college. And I liked it then without really a clear sense of how to respond to it or how to interpret it. And I reread it in preparation for the podcast today. And it was like a whole new experience reading it this time around. I really, really love this movie. Like you, Austin, I think David Lowry is one of our finest contemporary filmmakers. He's carving out a really interesting niche for himself, sort of straddling the line, doing some work with Disney here and there, doing some more accessible stuff that, like The Old Man and the Gun, which I watched this morning, and then doing stuff more on the meditative side of things like this and A Ghost Story, which is one of my favorite movies, just period. So I really, really love his work. I'm eager to talk about this film today, and I'm eager to talk about the history and the context of the story as well, because it's a beautifully written poem, but it's not really, you know, it scans like a poem technically, but it doesn't read like a poem. It's not rhyming every couplet here and there. So if you haven't read this, I highly recommend it. You can read it in just a couple hours. It's really quick and a really really interesting and fun read.
It's much more in the vein of like the Homeric epics, or of like the Roman epics. It's a tale, if you will, rather than just simply a poem, I guess.
Yeah, and I think there's some very interesting and informative differences between the text and the film that maybe we'll get into.
Cool. All right, Ryan, what about you, brother?
So I was not familiar with the poem or story at all. I guess my only familiarity with this whole thing is Disney's Sword in the Stone cartoon and A Kid in King Arthur Court.
Oh yeah. What about First Knight?
When I was a kid.
Did you ever see First Knight with Sean Connery and Richard Gere, and was it Juliette Binoche that's in that?
No, I didn't. And I'm talking about the kid in King Arthur's Court that was with the kid from Rookie of the Year
yes!
in the early 90s.
Yeah. Yes, I remember that.
Yeah. Anyway, I digress. So I don't really know much about it. I know a bunch of people that I know had read it in college and stuff. I guess I didn't take those courses. But usually these aren't the movies I kind of gravitate to, so I was kind of like, okay, I'm going to go see the Green Knight. It almost was like, in a weird way, this chore I had built up in my mind. But I really liked this movie a lot. Like, I was kind of enraptured the whole time watching it. It was a beautiful movie. I'm kind of surprised it exists because it is a pretty big budget, you know, kind of art house, I don't know, not super mainstream movie that seemed like it cost a lot of money, basically.
$15 million. So it looks okay. It looks a lot bigger. I mean, he got every dollar on the screen, but apologies.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, yeah, and so I was kind of waffling maybe towards the beginning about being like S.S. Cote in the chat says, this movie is incredible. It was unbelievably pretentious. And that did cross my mind in the early on. I'm like, all right, you know, is this basically a very indulgent, you know, student film made by, you know, I had never seen a David Lowery movie either, by the way. So I know you guys say that you guys love him.
Yeah.
And when I'm looking at every movie of his I've heard of, but I just haven't seen. I haven't seen Ain't This Body Saints. I haven't seen A Ghost Story. You know, and A Ghost Story, if I'm not wrong, was like beat up by the critics and stuff when it came out, right?
Yeah, but you, not necessarily, but
or maybe it was a huge bomb or something. Either way, like I this movie made me want to go see this guy's other stuff.
Cool.
Because clearly he's had a crazy career. His IMDb is insane for what you called a young director. He has like 20 producing credits, 27 directing mm-hmm. credits, 23 writing credits, 14 cinematography credits, and like you said, and then 36 editing credits. Like,
yeah,
he's been around the block. And I guess the only other movie I've seen of his is the Pete's Dragon remake,
yeah,
which I actually was pleasantly surprised,
yeah,
at,
same,
and how much I kind of enjoyed that movie, even though it's like, why make that movie? Anyway, long story short, I thought this movie was cool, and I maybe dragged a little bit in the middle, but it was so pretty to look at. I didn't give a shit. This movie was fun. And then you always got to go out with a bang with your movies. And I think that the very last line of this movie with the Green Knight going, all right, now off with your head.
Spoilers.
Oh, I'm sorry. Spoiler alert.
Hey, listen, this podcast is all spoilers all the time.
This is one big spoiler. Yeah.
Also spoilers for a 4,000-year-old poem.
Yeah, it's like going to see Titanic.
Well,
what
closer to like 1,400.
Yeah.
That's the part of the movie I would like to get y'all's meaning of,
yes,
you know, for the most, is
I've
the very, very end of the movie. What are we supposed to take away from the film? And then how do you interpret that line? And anyway, Austin, what'd you think about the film?
I really love your thoughts, Ryan. Yeah, so David Lowery's been one of my favorite filmmakers ever since Ain't Them Body Saints came out, which I thought was like a sort of nod, homage almost to early Malick. Which is, you know, Days of Heaven, yeah, is one of my
like
favorite
Bad
films
Lands,
of all time.
So.
And then, of course, Badlands is just one of the greatest films I think ever made. And so it was very similar in that vein, almost a bit derivative even. But I kind of loved it so much that I was kind of excusing the fact that you could see Malick's fingerprints all over it. As they say, great artists steal, right? And then I loved A Ghost Story. So I came into this with kind of a lot of expectation and hope and things like that. And here's the problem. I was exhausted last night when I watched this film. And I think I was mentally fatigued. And it was one of those things where I was watching it and I was going, this is fucking fantastic. And it's beautiful and it's gorgeous, but I'm really tired and I want to watch this again. I really wish I would have watched it in the theater. Like, that's my only thing. Like, I'm almost annoyed at myself that I didn't have the mental capacity to watch it. All that to say is
I saw it in the theater.
Yeah, see, I wish I could have, because I feel like had I watched it on the big screen, I would have been much more alert and engrossed. But my feet were up on the sofa and I was watching it on my TV, and it was kind of like, you know, it was a long day, and it was kind of like I knew that I had to watch it. And so it was also kind of like I just wasn't in the right frame, and I'm a little annoyed at myself, and I want to watch it again. But I will say this. The thing that I took away from it more than anything is there are frames and there are shots and there are color palettes that I will keep replaying in my mind over and over and over again. Particularly when he gets to the Green Chapel, the yellows and greens that are kind of framing him, and then how it kind of switches from that into a sort of more quote-unquote realistic rather than surrealist shot. And then some of the shots when they're in King Arthur's court, it wasn't as grandiose of a set, but then the framing was so much like a painting that I thought that there was some beautiful things that came from that with the lighting. And so I think it was absolutely wonderfully composed visually. And then I think in terms of this being a retelling of, you know, stories from the Middle Ages, is something that's really interesting because there's so many interesting religious themes, mythical themes. There's so much to dig into here. Who is the Green Knight? Why is the Green Knight green? What's the deal with the plants? Is this a nod to the green man historically? Is it Satan? Is it Christ? There's all kinds of different interpretations, some of them conflicting. So there's so much. What is this? Is this a tale of bravery, love, honor? Is this a warning? Is this, you know, some sort of tale of chivalry? I mean, it's called a chivalrous romance or chivalric romance, right? So there's so much here that I feel like we could talk about it.
It's a Christmas story.
And it's a fucking Christmas story on top of that, right? So what the fuck? There's so much to do. So I'm going to go and do a quick recap here. But before we do that, I got to give some shout outs here, some quick shout outs to some new stuff. We got some new merch, folks. New merch. So we got stickers. And if you want, you can go check those out. You can go to wisecrack.store. So you can check that madness out. We got our podcast logos for Culture Binge, obviously for Show Me the Meaning, and for the Squanch. So head over to wisecrack.store. You can check that out. And we got t-shirts coming soon, and the t-shirts are pretty sick. I can't wait to get a new t-shirt myself. So go check that madness out. Also, give us a follow over on Twitter. It is SMTM_POD. That's SMTM_POD. Also, shouts to Chunky Rivera, who just said Raymond is hot. Let's get into the recap. So we're going to go into the recap reel here, quick here. All right. So is it Gawain? Gawain? However the hell you say his name. Gawain, I'm going to say, attends a feast at his uncle King Arthur's court. The king invites Gawain to sit beside him, and the two discuss what it means to be great. At this same time, Gawain's mother is performing a magic ritual elsewhere. Now, at this time, the Green Knight enters the king's court, lays down a challenge, and basically says any knight who is able to land a blow on him will win his green axe. However, 1 year later, this knight must meet the Green Knight at the Green Chapel so that he can return the favor with the exact same blow. Now, only Gawain stands up to accept the challenge. Now, the Green Knight, oddly enough, does not fight back, but instead lowers his head, and Gawain beheads him. Then moments later, the Green Knight stands up, picks up his head pretty nonchalantly, then reminds Gawain of the deal and exits. Then we fast forward to a two quick year later. 1 year later, Gawain sets out to the Green Chapel to fulfill his end of the bargain. Gawain's ambushed in the forest, his axe is stolen, but then he eventually comes across an abandoned cabin where he's awakened when he's sleeping by the ghost of Winifred, who asks him to fetch her head from a nearby spring. He goes and gets the head, then he gets his axe back, so then he continues on his way. Then he reaches a castle near the Green Chapel. This castle's run by a lord and the lord's mistress, who's making sexual advances at him. Is this nods to the Joseph story from the Old Testament? I don't know. Tell us what you think in the chat. She makes these sexual advances. He's rebuffing them, but then one morning, Gawain gives in to her advances in exchange for the green girdle, where he ejaculates all over it, and I had somebody on Twitter asking me, what's the deal with all the cum? So I guess we can talk about that a little bit as well.
Yes, he ends let's up talk about the cum.
Fleeing from the castle, and he finally reaches the Green Chapel. Now, when the Green Knight finally awakens from his little slumber, Gawain must decide whether he runs away in fear, or does he follow through with his end of the bargain, and if he lets the Green Knight return the blow and chop his head off. At this time, though, Gawain has this vision of fleeing and returning home, of becoming king, then becoming a disgraced king, and then ultimately losing his head one day. Then he awakens from this vision, he removes the girdle, and says that he is ready to accept his end of the deal. The Green Knight then praises him for his bravery, and then cheekily runs his finger across Gawain's throat, saying, "Now, off with your head." End of film. Oh, but wait, there's a post-credit scene. What is this, a fucking Marvel film? And in the post-credit scene, there's a young girl who finds a king's crown and places it on her head. What could this possibly mean? I have no clue, but we're going to talk about it on the other side of a quick little ad. Got to give a shout out to Skillshare. Skillshare, you know about them. We talk about them all the time. They're an online learning community. They're sick because you can connect with other like-minded people and creatives where you can explore projects that you're passionate about. That's why Skillshare is so cool, because you can unleash your creativity and pursue your passions right from the convenience of your home. And they offer thousands of classes for creative and curious people on topics such as iPhone photography, editing, drone filming, classes on improving productivity, video for IG, composition, artivism, etc., 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 etc. So if you want to explore your creativity and connect with some cool people, go to Skillshare.com/SMTM and you'll get a free trial of their premium membership. That's Skillshare.com/SMTM and you get a free trial of their premium membership. Skillshare.com/SMTM or click the link down in the show notes. All right. So much to talk about here. I guess, Ryan, let's start it off. Let's start at the end. We'll start at the end. What does the Green Knight mean? Now off with your head. Does he stand up and chop off Gawain's head? Or was he cheekily just running his finger across his neck saying, okay, that is my returned blow to you, and because of your bravery, you have now passed the test because you've mastered the test and you've been rewarded. What else is going on here? What do you think? What is your interpretation of this ending? And what are people saying on the interwebs, too?
Well, those were my two interpretations, was either you went through all this and, yeah, I'm about to chop your head off, you know, but it's obviously a choice to not show that part. So why wouldn't you show that? Mm. That's, you know, my first interpretation. The second interpretation is what you just said is, oh, that was it. And then he's just kind of making a joke, which is bizarre because we haven't seen the Green Knight joke the whole time. Raymond, what do you think? Yeah, because I need you to show me these meanings.
Well, no, I was just going to say that while we maybe haven't seen him joke throughout the film, at the very beginning of it, he says quite pointedly, this is a game. And then Arthur reminds Gawain of that when he's handing over Excalibur. He says, don't forget that this is just a game. And it's Gawain that takes things too far. He's the one who decides he's going to step up. He's going to impress. He wants to show off. He wants to be bold and brave and courageous and just nip this thing in the bud, slices the dude's head off. And the knight even says at the outset, you know, be it a strike to the neck or a nick on the cheek or whatever his wording is, you know, the implication being if you are courageous enough to step up and just be playful with me, then I'm not going to kill you a year from now. I'll just give you a nick on the cheek in return.
So if he just bent down and Gawain walked over and just kind of like kicked him with his foot and then they laughed and had like a little chuckle, then that would have been a very different year spent in preparation for the return.
Yeah.
but doesn't King Arthur, which by the way, you've already shown me some meeting, Austin, because I'm an idiot, and I went the whole movie not even realizing that was King Arthur.
Arthur and Guinevere, death. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it makes perfect sense. Anyway, but doesn't he say the line about, hey, this is just a game, after he's already decapitated the Green Knight, you know?
No, like, isn't it when Gawain is stepping into the circle, he takes Excalibur and he steps up to... steps up to the knight,
okay.
Because maybe after he slices his head off, the only thing, it cuts to Arthur and Guinevere's reactions, who very clearly perceive this as like a moral failure on, or, you know, maybe I'm projecting or that's how I interpreted the scene, but Arthur and Guinevere's reactions to it are like, ah, he fucked up, you know?
Mm.
But there's also the fact that we see Morgan Le Fay summoning the Green Knight at the same time that Arthur is going around and giving his sort of monologue around the table there. It's not until the end of the book that you find out that Morgan Le Fay was summoned, or was the one who was responsible for sending the Green Knight. And also in the movie, this is a kind of a complicating factor, Morgan Le Fay is cast as Gawain's mother, which is not consistent with any Arthurian lore. So the other thing to add to this is that in addition to it being a game in the hopes of, like, teaching Gawain a lesson, it's kind of being motivated by his mom, whose couch he's crashing on.
And it's which, like, I like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like it's like the old-timey version of, all right, I need to
get out of the house.
My son needs to get off his fucking ass and go get a job and become a knight.
And Arthur is his uncle. So there's some relationship that Arthur has with Gawain's mother as well that they don't really explain too much. But, you know, so there's also a family thing here, which I don't know if that is in the original poem.
So, no, because in the, well, he's related to Arthur, at least I think in a lot of interpretations he's Arthur's nephew. I can't remember if they state that clearly in the poem. But at the end of the poem, he's still wearing the girdle. The knight is about to deal the blow, and he flinches, similar to the ending of this film. And then he does follow through with a strike that only results in a nick on Gawain's neck. And then he tosses the girdle aside, and he and the knight have a laugh together. They weirdly, out of nowhere, have a conversation about how it's all women's fault. And then they, like, rattle off a bunch of women from, like, from Eve through to Bathsheba. It's just a very bizarre turn for it to take, but it's like this very bro-y moment where the two of them get up and they're like, see, this was a fun game and now you're a man of honor. And then he goes back to Camelot, and then all the knights of the round table start wearing green sashes as like a tribute to Gawain's sort of courage throughout that. Obviously, this ending is very different insofar as it cuts before we see any of that. But also, if you listen to interviews with David Lowry, he kind of implies that he doesn't really know if it would end as happily. Like, to him, the most important thing is that Gawain learns this lesson, and that, you know, with that montage at the end, his options are really like, you can return home a dead man either way. You'll either have a head or you won't. But if you don't go through with this, if you're not like a man of courage and a man of honor, and you don't stand by your word, then what is your life really worth? And so I think he even said explicitly in one interview, he was like, I don't know, I think Gawain gets his head cut off, but it's just like, what matters is that he commits to it, and that is his hero's journey. But, you know, of course he doesn't show that.
So in your mind, he what happens in the book happens, he just leaves and they have a little laugh and then he becomes his hero with legends told about him.
In the movie, I think my interpretation, at least when I saw it, was that he was going to let him off with just that little joke. But David Lowry kind of, like I said, he says otherwise in interviews. But I mean, the audience owns this movie as much as David Lowry does. And I think if your interpretation of it coming away is that, you know, Gawain grew as a person and he learned his lesson and he's now going to be given the gift of an honorable life, then I think that's a totally valid interpretation.
There was a thing that I saw, the whole ending where his life flashes before his eyes about what would happen, right? We've seen that before, right? In a movie, I think it's
in like
Last Temptation of Christ
as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. The 25th Hour does that. Last Temptation of Christ does that. I want to say that a recent Rick and Morty episode did that. and another recent movie. Anyway, it's a cool. I like the cinematic.
The Last Temptation is an interesting reference because then it's almost as though he's being sacrificial in continuing to go through with the bravery. Because remember, when Jesus is on the cross, too, he does cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And G.K. Chesterton and famously Slavoj Žižek has kind of run with this and said, you know, even for a moment, God himself becomes an atheist, right? And so many kind of thinkers have lingered over this moment when Jesus is screaming on the cross. Like, what could that mean? Why are the authors writing it in this way? Like, what is going on? Why would this man of, quote, like, perfect faith and trust all of a sudden have moments of doubt? So there's something interesting about that potentially with Gawain, too, because I know that a lot of thinkers like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and other medievalists, and I actually had a phone conversation with a friend of mine who's a medieval scholar, and we were chatting about some of the figures here, like, obviously this is written in a very sort of a period of Christendom. So these allusions are going to be intentional and probably quite heavy at times. And if they do have this conversation about women, everyone talking about from Eve all the way through Bathsheba, there are themes of like sexual temptation, which would then kind of like lead you down a particular path about sticking with kind of like your manhood and bravery and honor and things like that. And then of course, you could potentially think of the green man as being like a serpent in the garden. Right? The Green Knight is laying down a challenge. Like, what are you going to do here? Are you going to abuse your power and chop my head off? Are you going to just be playful with me? And then, however you take it, then are you going to then follow through with your end of the bargain, dealing with the consequences that you've set before yourself? Are you going to see through it to the end? And then will you be rewarded for that patience and bravery or courage? What have you learned over this course of the year, right? Things like that. So I think there's a lot of stuff that we could kind of chew on here. And then does that mean then that somehow Gawain is on a sort of like messianic journey? Because if he didn't go through with it, if he didn't get his head chopped off, he would have become a disgraced king. And does he bring his kingdom into war, where then his child is ended up, you know, dying, which we see like in the visions, right? And then does he lose Camelot? Does Camelot fall because of the consequences of his cowardice, right? So there's so much to think about here in that context as well, that has like religious allusions and of course political illusions, because he's preserving the crown. He's the king, right? So he's protecting Camelot.
I think the implication of that that silent montage, that wonderful montage in the third act there, that shows his kind of imagined life from this moment as the kind of, you know, fork in the road. I think the implication is that if he doesn't live with honor in this moment, then he will never live with honor or abide by honor in any way going forward, and that this will taint all of his decisions going forward, and he'll never be able to hold himself to that standard of integrity again. But in addition to that, you bring up the question of like Christianity, and this movie is so steeped in that kind of conversation of like, of the sort of encroachment of Christianity onto like pagan land and into pagan cultures. Mm. And, you know, from that very first moment in the, or not the very first moment in the film, but the one to which we referred earlier, where Morgan Le Fay is casting the spell and Arthur is kind of giving his speech, Arthur's crown is literally designed to make him look like a religious icon with like the round halo behind his head. And while Morgan is like bone scrying and casting these spells and stuff, a lot of the time they're edited and framed, like the pacing is such that they're moving in the same direction. Their bodies are like in the same sort of momentum across the frame at the same pace. And they're like very clearly, he's sort of tying these sort of rituals together in a way that I found very interesting. And I think it's a very subtle, but very much intentional sort of visual commentary that he makes throughout the film, even as you get towards the Green Chapel and Gawain is seeing like the Celtic cross that is decaying, yes, and being consumed by nature. And there's all kinds of stuff like that throughout the film, even like the inclusion of Saint Winifred in this film, which isn't a part of the text, but if you know anything about Christian mythology, do you know the story of Saint Winifred? So I'll try to keep this brief, but I think it is an interesting tangent. So I was raised Catholic. I used to be a Catholic youth minister, and I'm still kind of obsessed with Christian mythology, just because so much of it is like extraordinarily ghastly, and a lot of it just amounts to just straight up ghost stories. And the story of Saint Winifred is fucking metal as hell. So she was this young Welsh woman who was kind of stricken with divine inspiration. At least as I recall, she was going to join a nunnery. And one of her, it was her, I don't know if they were together, or I can't remember exactly, but a boyfriend or a suitor of hers came and lopped her head off because he didn't take kindly to the notion of her abstaining from their relationship to give herself to God. And her head falls off her body, and when it hits the ground, it creates this spring. And then I think it was her uncle or her father went and grabbed the head off the ground and replaced it on her body and brought her back to life. So she was canonized a saint as a martyr. And to this day, the Saint Winifred's Well, I think it was called like Holy Well, or it's in a place in Wales called Holy Well. And for a while, the water fountain or the water source was called Holy Head. And to this day, it's still seen as like a pilgrimage site. It's, you know, it's like the Lords of Wales, it's referred to because of the healing waters. And that whole sequence is this great moment of like these two legends sort of crossing paths and Gawain becoming the one who retrieves her head rather than her uncle. And I really, really like that notion that Lowry keeps playing with in this movie, that like, In much the same way that he shows the built environment being overtaken by nature through the presence of the Green Knight, like even when the Green Knight sets his axe down and the grass starts grows, to like yeah. flow out from beyond it. And then of course the Green Knight's appearance, which in the book he's just like really big. He's not a big tree or anything like that. And then this, he looks like an ent. I do like that kind of implication that as the built environment, whether it is an architectural, physical built environment or an ideological environment that is built by man, it's going to be subsumed by nature. Eventually, like as much as, you know, civilization has encroached upon the natural environment, when all of that falls, when mythology itself starts to crumble, what takes it back over is grass and like the natural rate of decay. And so I do, I think there is something really like really, really beautiful and really complex that he's saying about just even like the nature of storytelling and maybe filmmaking itself, that like all of this is temporary and, you know, this movie shows like the living embodiment of a myth succumbing to a living embodiment of nature. And I just think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, there's something interesting. So there's lots of, again, debate about who the Green Knight is. And one of the historical references is the figure of the Green Man, who is variously depicted kind of with the face, the mask looking very similar to how
it's me, man.
Listen, everybody. He's the Green Man.
I'm the Green Knight.
Did you pregame for this movie the same way you pregame for the podcast, Ryan?
Oh yeah, baby. Sorry to cut you off, Austin. I just had to claim my throne as the Green Knight.
That is nature coming in and bursting in. That is herbal nature asserting its dominance into the techno waves of this podcast. But yeah, so you've got the Green Man, who is kind of like nature, right? The embodiment of nature, and like. It symbolizes rebirth and growth and fecundity and things like that, right? And fertility. And so there's an interesting discussion going on in the live chat right now. I just want to shout out Nicolette and Andrea were talking about so Nicolette says, you know, I thought the religious allusions were telling a myth of Britain and equating nature to paganism. And then Andrea was saying, yeah, like the talking fox. And so I thought also of Antichrist as soon as I saw the talking fox. And one of the things that's interesting is in the modern era, we kind of view nature as a place of serenity, a place that is uncorrupted, right? A place that is outside of the hustle and bustle of the city. But in the Middle Ages and in the kind of ancient mythologies, nature was a place of death. It was terrifying. It was scary as fuck. Right? And so a film like Antichrist kind of really leans into that view rather than the sort of like modern post-Enlightenment view of nature as being a place for like bourgeois fantasies to go and retreat and recline and enjoy, like the Walden story or something like that, right? And rather what you get in fucking Antichrist, you get a talking fox that says chaos reigns, right? And as soon as this fucking fox opened his mouth and started talking, I kind of immediately thought, I was like, okay, so I don't know if that was a direct reference or some sort of like intertextual reference to Antichrist, but I was thinking a lot about the role of nature sort of taking over. And that's why I think a lot of scholars have looked at the Green Knight as being potentially a figure that represents like the devil, as a tempter, a trickster, you might say, which is a very sort of well-worn trope for deities in the ancient and pre-modern world, that there is a trickster god, right? Even in the Old Testament, you see God playing the role of the trickster as he's depicted sometimes. So it seeped its way into Christianity as Christianity appropriates and adopts a lot of these kind of larger cultural trends and religious theological trends. So I think there's something here about nature as being powerful, about rebirth, about fertility, right? And then potentially about also signaling death, something that is against quote-unquote civilization or like the artificial constructions of humans. And then I think we need to tie that into sex, because I think that there's something so important about sex, procreation, rebirth, desire, lust. There's something so important about that, where you have the mother figure who's testing. You have him who wakes up in a brothel, right? And he's lying about saying that he was at mass. So I think it's important that we understand that he is engaged in a sexual relationship with a quote-unquote commoner, right? Like, she's not a lady of the court. She's a commoner. And he wakes up in this brothel. So there's, again, something about maybe illicit sexual activity. And then it's something about, like, the sexual desire and ejaculation that relates to fecundity, and that sort of when he's being seduced by the lady, and he ejaculates all over the green girdle, and then he's able to get it, and then he has to remove the girdle at the end. So there's a lot of stuff going on here that I'm throwing out a lot of shit, I know, but there's so much to kind of unpack here. So just pick them, and let's start peeling it apart here.
On that note, the other thing I forgot to mention about the ending of the text is that you find out that the Green Knight and the Lord, played by Joel Edgerton, are actually the same person. And the reason that he goes on his like anti-woman rant is because throughout like the third chapter, which is the longest chapter of the book, the lady of the house keeps kind of similar to the movie. She keeps, you know, trying to seduce Gawain, and he keeps rebuffing her advances. And it is very explicitly, like, tied into that notion of, you know, he is, in much the same way that he has been sent to, I don't necessarily know if it's explicitly to spur Gawain towards greatness, but he is sent to test Gawain, and then he ends up sending the lady of the house to test Gawain turn. And so there's like a handful of puppet masters going down the line here. And as he reveals at the end, he says, you know, like that you kept this girdle and you only exchanged the kisses that were given to you in my household and things like that. So I do think there is in that very like misogynist old world view. Yeah, you're right. They may be explicitly tying the temptation that's associated with like femininity to I don't necessarily know that the book portrays him as like a satanic figure, but I guess in some ways nature is regularly equated to not just the feminine but just like freedom and you know, shamelessness and stuff, like, you know, the Garden of Eden designed to be this sort of heavenly respite ends up becoming like an icon of just temptation and lust or whatever. That's definitely something I hadn't fully considered at the time, but that's a good point.
To me, the way I took those themes that you're talking about, the sex and whatnot, it's like, you know, this movie's a glorified coming of age movie, right? Where, you know, it's the loss of innocence. You know, it's Stand By Me. They have to go on this crazy adventure to at some point realize, oh, this is what life's about. It's not like, you know, he's heard all the fairy tales and whatever, or the stories of knights his whole life, and here he is older, and he's just, you know, having casual sex, getting fucked up, and just doesn't care about anything, and he needs honor. He needs to become, you know, what these great stories he's heard about, and so then he has to go on one big adventure himself. So to me, that's where like the sex theme kind of just that's where that comes from.
Could we say that this is also about him then overcoming or confronting the temptations that would come once you go into nature, right? Because that's all these stories of Little Red Riding Hood, of going outside of the city walls, going outside of the comforts of what humans have built with their religious institutions, which are meant to protect and control nature. Not control nature in the sense necessarily of domination, although it could lead in that way, but also just to mitigate the effects of famine and to mitigate the effects of the rains that come. So going out into nature is fucking terrifying, because that's where it's free in the bad sense, because it's wild, because it's not regulated and managed and controlled, and you don't know where your meal is going to come from, and disease is going to fucking eat you and shit like that. And this is why I think a lot of times the feminine has been associated with nature, right? Like, I'm also thinking now of the fucking Darren Aronofsky film, Mother, right? Where you have clearly the poet, which I think we did like on our first, was that our first episode or second?
Jared said it was the first one, yeah.
It was in the top three, ever did. Yeah.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, and so what you've got is you've got the poet, you know, Javier Bardem's character, who is the artist, the creator, the one who erects structure. And then you have Jennifer Lawrence, who is this fertile, always wearing white and pure, and she's Mother Earth, and she just wants to maintain domesticity, right? And you have these two poles that in various religious and theological interpretations were two forms or expressions of the deity, the divine feminine and the divine masculine, you know? In some religious traditions, it's yin and yang, it's Apollo and Dionysus, it's, you know, been expressed in various different ways, structure and flow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that's something that's being played here as well, with sexual desire being one experienced, but then repressed and then potentially overcome or managed or confronted until he gets to the end when he undoes the girdle and then he allows his head to be chopped off, which somebody in the chat, I can't remember who it was, but shouts to you because I can't find it now, but said that it was also about the elimination of ego. right? Which was setting himself aside for the larger cause. And I think there's a lot to that that we could consider
and
as well.
I also think that a lot of the film's mission is to, in consideration of all of that, to kind of subvert the sort of, you know, like the repression of this, the era in which this was written is kind of like, it's inevitable, you know, it's kind of like baked into the cake a little bit. And I do like that it seems as though David Lowery is kind of turning that on its head a little bit and examining that in unique ways. Sorry, I'm looking for who contributed that. Ryan, what do you think?
What do I think about what you just said?
No, just like the stuff overall.
Yeah, no, I agree. My answer is yes.
No, it's. I think there's. There's
his
like...
answer is he just took a bong rip and he kind of zoned out for a second.
No, I did not. I take bong rips for all of these podcasts.
I just distracted myself because I was trying to find to whom we should attribute that really thoughtful contribution to the chat.
Yeah, his mind wandered.
Yeah, that one's on me. I gotta take that one.
Through osmosis, he got a little faded. Do we think then that this is a morality tale, right? Like, is that essentially not in just the Arthurian form, which clearly it would be, David Lowery? And if so, is David Lowery trying to subvert a lot of these more kind of old-fashioned tales? I mean, I hesitate to use the term, but I guess we could, patriarchal stories, and that he's kind of offering us something else, which is also what I mentioned, you know, that there is a post-credit scene where a young girl finds the king's crown and places it on her head. So is there something also about us dealing with the established power relations of kind of sexual difference?
For me, the question you just posed to us, is it a morality tale, was what I meant when I really wanted to investigate the final line of the movie, because to me it would be really cool if he actually did just go, oh, and off with your head, and then you literally see him get his head cut off.
Yeah.
So then what is the lesson there, that don't try to show off or else, you know, here's the consequences, or, you know, nature's going to beat your ass, basically, or you bit off more than you can chew. It's like a super cynical ending. Or is it kind of how Raymond had phrased it, that it's like, and this was basically a big test, you know, and now go on and live this fruitful life. And the fact that they cut before you really know, even though I guess the consensus is that he does, that's it. It's just, you know, he just hits it with his finger. I think that it is leaving it to a little open to interpretation about, you know, and whatnot. And so, yeah, like I liked the just epic nature of the whole presentation of the story. And apparently, I think that this movie does work way better if you have read the stuff, apparently, because in terms of grasping the narrative more, because I certainly was just kind of left absorbing this different time and place that they were putting me into the movie, and way less at the end going, okay, now let's dissect what all that meant, is kind of how it that was less of my enjoyment of the movie going, wow, okay, I'm really like on board with it, or knowing exactly what's going on in a given moment. They're literally on giants for like 2 minutes all of a sudden, and you're like, well, I guess that matter, you know, didn't really matter. That was just how he got somewhere, but where did giants come from? Now they're gone.
And there's this amazing tracking shot when he first leaves Camelot and he's just walking for a minute, and I'm thinking of like the Turin horse, right? And it's just him on this horse with these
Turin
kids behind
again,
him, and he's
baby.
Just my yeah, come on. Yeah,
your
you know,
favorite
what is it?
Movie, man.
Bingo? Their bingo card?
Yeah.
Come on. Yeah, that and Wings of Desire. Got to get my references in every episode that I can. But no, there's this lovely tracking shot where it's just him on this horse just gently walking, and I was looking at the background. I mean, clearly there was some sort of CG going on there, but it was just so well done. It was so well framed. It looked like a painting. It was slow and it was deliberate, and it was meditative, but at the same time, the frames were so full, and there was so much intrigue as to, like, this part of the story was leading to this next interesting thing. And then at moments, you get, like you said, Ryan, a fucking giant that kind of is like, oh, cool. Or you meet, like, the scavenger guy who, you know, robs Gawain, which I didn't see that coming until he gets ambushed a little bit later. And I was like, ah, that clever little fucker, you know? So there's little moments like that. But then there's also these really, like, meditative shots. There's this 360-degree shot where he's lying down, right? And
it when returns it's on to him his decayed first, body. Yeah.
Turns to his decayed body, and then it comes back, and it's like that kind of shot. And then, of course, a very Malick-y shot where it just kind of like goes, pans up the trees and into the forest canopy above, you know? And like, there are these wonderful art house, for lack of a better term, kind of shots and
frames.
But
what
does
it mean, Austin?
What does it mean?
I want to jump back in with some contributions to the chat. First of all, sorry I lost my train of thought earlier. I was looking for Tommy Folderton. He was the listener who left the ego comment that you cited earlier. A few moments later, Jay Skiv contributed to the chat, and he said something. He put it all quite succinctly. We should bring him on the show. He could save everyone an hour of time. He said, if you can't die with honor, you won't live with honor. There's also a wonderful contribution here from Ryan Laredo saying, paganism is the worship of the land. The two parallels are no accident as a commentary on the city and Christianity having a single influence on pagan Britain, even more so with Arthur and his sister. Now, to come back to the question of, like, David Lowry bringing this movie into a more sort of contemporary context. I think that's a little bit of what we're sort of nibbling around right now. I think that's of a whole with, like, his entire filmography in a really weird way. That this movie, I think, you can see a direct line. I think the clearest connection is probably between this and A Ghost Story. But he has this tendency to work within these frameworks of mythology, but he brings that sort of humanizing element to it. Ryan, like you said, this movie is, for all intents and purposes, a medieval John Hughes movie. Like, this is about this guy's coming of age and learning not to be a cad as much as it is about anything. Whereas in the text, like, he's not really fleshed out. He doesn't seem all that human, you know? He does make a few mistakes or errors in judgment here and there, but he's not, like, all that compelling. He's just sort of a mythical figure or iconic figure. But if you look at his movies going back to, you know, Austin, you mentioned Ain't Them Body Saints and something like Old Man and the Gun, those are very much movies about kind of humanizing that trope of either the gentleman bandit or the lovers on the run. And all of his movies have this tendency to take, like, a springboard either from folklore or mythology or with a ghost story, just the framework of the tradition of ghost stories themselves, and figuring out a way to draw some humanity out of these characters that have become, like, very staid or rigid or archetypal within these subgenres. And I do think in this movie specifically, you do see a lot of really interesting growth. Every single challenge along the way for Dev Patel, you just pull a little bit more humanity out of him, and if you don't see him change that drastically, you see the will to change forming behind his eyes, that he's experiencing the hardships of life for the first time. He's being punished for his hubris as he's having to, like, take shelter on a cliffside in the rain and forage for mushrooms that may or may not cause him to hallucinate those giants walking across the land. And I think that there's, you know, a lot of that you could say is the intent that David Lowry brings to it. But I also want to give credit to Dev Patel. I think he's phenomenal in this movie. And David Lowry was talking about his big influences on this film, one of which was The Passion of Joan of Arc, the Carl Theodor Dreyer film, which is an historical epic rendered almost entirely in close-up. And you really do see that influence, that you have those big, beautiful, trippy vistas that the Ryan Haleys of the world really love. But also when he gets into close-up on Dev Patel, you're like, yeah, I'm watching a man go on a journey here. Like, you can see something
behind his
eyes.
There's one in particular. There's one in particular that really brought my attention to what was going on in terms of the craft of the direction. It was actually early on when Gawain is sitting next to Arthur, and Dev Patel just holds his eyes on Arthur and does not move for about a minute and a half as Arthur is kind of talking to him about greatness and how he will have his opportunity, right? And Dev Patel literally does not, I think he blinks one time, and it was actually almost like a perfectly timed blink, whether that was editing or whether that was the performance. It was a perfectly timed blink where it's something that is said that is almost like, at this moment, Dev Patel accepts what is said to him, right? And then he just holds the gaze again. And it was also kind of, you see the power as well, because he's looking up at the king. And as soon as I saw that intimacy, then matched with the wide shot behind of the court, which I guess I watched a little interview with David Lauber, where he says it actually was painted.
They had some matte painting on the edges of the frame.
Which I thought was really kind of a lovely touch, which I really enjoy that use of different artistic mediums. So I think, and then of course, you know, that long shot that I was talking about, that tracking shot is just this massive, like fucking Lawrence of Arabia, like super wide, right? Like super fucking wide shot. And you have that, and then you have this
wonderful. Are you thinking of the one where the camera inverts?
That as well. That's another one that is absolutely fantastic. There's so much wonderful, like, directorial flourishes. And then there's my favorite edit of the film was when he's sitting next to what's his mistress name, is it Essel?
Yeah, Alicia
he's
Buckander.
Talking with Essel, and she has that bell, and she shakes the bell, and as she, it's on the movement, on the hand movement of him shaking the bell, it flashes back to her quick shake of the bell, and then it goes back to him. And I was like, there's just this beautiful cross cut, right, of bringing those two moments together, that things like that I was paying attention to a lot of, which again might be like, oh, these are simple things, but they create such a mood and a tone and a feel, and it pulls you in so well that it, I don't know, it really is just kind of a wonderful testament to him and his craft as a filmmaker, right? And seeing him grow from Ain't Them Bodies Saints through to Pete's Dragon, now into this, and I didn't see, what is it, The Old Man with a Gun? I didn't see it, but I heard about it. I didn't see it.
Yeah. It's not my favorite of his films, but like I said, I watched it this morning, and I liked it, but it seems a little bit more, you know, it's certainly more accessible, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it feels maybe a little bit more slight. There's not as much to chew on there, but it's also based on a true story, and, you know, it has some of his more stylistic fringes kind of cut off. It's, you know, it's made for more of a broad audience appeal. But to bring it back to the Giants, I wanted to shout out Jay Skiv again, who's just been lighting up the chat. He had a really thoughtful comment here. Great metaphorical reasoning that Gawain attempts to stand on the shoulders of giants, but they deny him so he can forge his own path. And there is kind of an interesting parallel with David Lowery talking about the history of his filmmaking, Austin, that he has this kind of, you know, you always hear about filmmakers doing one for me, one for them, that sort of thing. Pete's Dragon, you can, you know,
one for them.
Yeah, you can probably say one for them, although he clearly cares quite a bit about that material, and he holds it.
Well, he's
high
doing
regard.
The new Peter Pan film too.
Yes, he's, I think, be doing, it's the like new Peter Pan and Wendy film, or something like that.
Peter and Wendy, yeah.
And I think that fits within the framework, like I was talking about before, of like finding these sort of fantastic or mythological ideas that he can find a way to kind of subvert or contemporize, or however you want to put it. A Ghost Story was this movie that he kind of famously, when he was working on Pete's Dragon, was like, you know, I'm proud of this movie, but I really want to get back to that thing of like my first movie, like Saint Nick, where you get $12,000 and you and your friends go out and find a house to just shoot in. And he was like, I'm just going to write this movie about a guy in a sheet, and it's going to be this weird sort of take on the ghost story. And this was kind of coming from a similar place, as big as this movie seems. And it certainly is, you know, like we were saying before, I mean, it's all up there on the screen. He knocks it out of the park, especially considering how relatively low this budget is. This movie is very much a passion project for him. He said the first script that he ever wrote was an adaptation of St. Percival and the Fisher King. He tried to get it performed at his local community theater in Texas. He was never able to get it on its feet, but he had been harboring this notion for a long time of being able to make a fantasy film or something about Arthurian lore. And that when he was, I think it was when he was coming out of Old Man and the Gun, he started thinking, like, trying to get the creative juices flowing, and picked up Sir Gawain and the Green Knight just to, you know, get his head back into a medieval or fantastic mind space. And he was like, well, this is just a book about a guy walking. I could do this for like 15 grand. You know, it ended up being 15 million, but it still has that sense of like childhood wonder that you can tell he's been harboring these fantasies of you know, myth and legend. And I really like that you get this kind of ground level fantasy that, yes, it is big and epic at points, but at the end of the day, it's really just about one person's battle with themselves. And I think it's really, really special. And you know, he's a special filmmaker. I'm glad that we have
about one man walking.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Austin,
I can do that. Yeah.
You had started this by asking me about the last line of the film, and I would like to ask you about the first line of the film, which is when she throws the water on him and then goes, "Christ is born." Do you think that that's setting us up for, you know, is this a Jesus story disguised as a coming of age story, disguised as a King Arthur story, a hero's journey, all wrapped in one? Burrito?
Yes. Yeah, okay. I do think so. I think I really like thinking of allusions, right? Rather than thinking it is this or it is that. Like, what is this film potentially alluding to? And so I absolutely think that Gawain is kind of like a Christ figure, some sort of messianic figure who ultimately comes to the point of sacrificing himself at the end, despite the immediate pain that he is anticipating he will receive. And this is what I think is so fun about the end. I think that he doesn't cut off his head, actually. I think it's just this cheeky, you have sacrificed yourself, kind of like the commenter said about sacrificing the ego. You already have died by putting yourself in a position to allow me to chop off your head, but because you're not immortal, I was, so I kind of fooled you to begin with because I knew that anything you do wasn't actually going to harm me, so whatever, I always had a one-up on you. It's kind of like a Satan tempting Job sort of thing, right? Is like, I'm going to put you through the hardship, and in the end, you're going to be rewarded ultimately. And I think at the end, he gives him that cheeky look and he runs his thumb across his neck and he says, "Now off with your head." I think that that's kind of like a wink, wink, nod, nod. You've done it. Well done, my good boy. Now you can go back and you've saved Camelot. Because had you not done that, you would not have saved Camelot. So I think he's very much a Jesus figure. And the water and the baptism, that's absolutely a John the Baptist. Jesus starts his ministry with being baptized by John the Baptist in the wilderness.
A man whose head was eventually cut off.
A man whose head was eventually cut off. Right. So I absolutely think that he is a Jesus figure.
But Jesus doesn't start off, you know, he's always kind of Jesus-like. He's not in brothels, you know, getting drunk. Yeah. You know?
But I think this is one of the interesting ways of kind of playing. Jesus-like. He's always kind of Jesus, like, yeah. Yeah, he always had his Jesus thing, right? But this is one of the interesting things about, like, different interpretations of theology. You know, I said earlier there are these interpretations made famous by a theologian named G.K. Chesterton, where Jesus literally becomes an atheist on the cross. Not in the sense that we think of it now, like Richard Dawkins, grumpy-faced, I'm going to try to, like, argue with you people all the time because, you know, I think religion is stupid kind of atheist, but much more of, like, he doubts fully.
He doubts
and there's
God,
a term
yeah.
in... Yeah, he doubts God, and he doubts his ministry. And there's a term that's used that's the word kenosis, which means an emptying of oneself. This is the Greek term that's used, right? And so the idea is at that moment that the divinity of Jesus is emptied completely, and what we see is the humanity of Jesus. So a lot of times in these old tales, you get these tellings that could be deemed heretical in some ways, but you get these tellings that talk about, like, different aspects of theology that aren't, you know, exposited in the religious texts or in the interpretations of those religious texts. And I think that what you get is a real human tale that is kind of saying, you too can accede to the level of divinity. And this is a term in theology that's called apotheosis, which is an idea that you can become like God, right? Not that you can become like God in the sense of omnipotent and all-knowing and stuff like that, but rather in the sense that we are trying to transcend out of our human condition and accede to the levels of transcendent ideas, the ideals of bravery, the ideals of the highest ideals of courage, of truth, of beauty, of justice. We can transcend to those if we pass certain tests. And so I think that's kind of what we could look at this tale as doing, is it's giving us a real human story, but in it you see a man who transcends to the level of divinity, and he ultimately then saves Christendom, or he saves Camelot, by his transcending of the weaknesses of the flesh, right?
And this Something also like returns gotcha. To the tension of kind of paganism versus Christianity, because, of course, this movie and the story starts on Christmas, which is now celebrated as the birth of Christ, but long before that was celebrated as a pagan holiday. It was, you know, Yule to Germanic cultures. It
That's
was
right.
Saturnalia
That's
right. to Roman cultures. Like it is one of those things where, like, there is this inherent tension when you start to unpack any of this stuff, because, like, once again, the cyclical nature of nature itself, like we were saying, or like I was saying before, that, you know, these things start as celebrations of nature, they get co-opted by religion, and now kind of have come back on the other side to, like, my Jewish cousins celebrate Christmas by eating a ham every year. Like, it's essentially a secular religion again, or it's, excuse me, a secular holiday again, because everybody celebrates Christmas. And there is a like, once again, a weird kind of commentary that he's making on this. And I think, you had mentioned, I'm crossing the streams again between our conversation and the chat, but some folks are bringing up the fox, Austin. I wanted to throw that your way.
Yep.
I have some theories on the fox, but I'm curious what you and Ryan maybe think about that. Oh, and by the way, we actually have a surprise guest today. The fox from The Green Knight is here.
Oh, whoa. Chaos
Who's this?
Reigns.
Oh, little Foxy.
We just adopted
That's
her
so
a week
cute.
Ago. She's clinging to
she's
us.
Adorable.
Nice.
Sorry.
Okay,
sorry,
look,
go on.
we're going long, so let's have this be the last thing that we say, and fuck, email us, and then we can address this in, like, the mailbag section in coming weeks, okay? Ryan, what do you think about the fox?
To me, it was just another cool, weird, mystical nature thing to add into the other weird shit. You got a giant, a talking fox. He's seeing weird stuff that he doesn't see in normal everyday life, because he's losing his innocence as he's coming of age, because he's Jesus and he's King Arthur and all these references.
Did you think the Von Trier Antichrist thing? Like, whenever I see a talking fox, I always think fucking Antichrist.
Yeah, I see where your head's at, but no, I didn't. I just assumed that this talking fox was part of this ancient poem that I'm not aware of, is where what I thought. I didn't
know.
But, you know.
Actually, it's not. That's the kind of the weird the weird thing is that in the poem, similar to how, like, St. Winifred is never mentioned in the poem, but Holyhead is, there's a brief mention of he walks near Holyhead. the fox is just something that the lord in the castle, the Joel Edgerton character, he traps the fox, and on the third day he returns with it. On the first 2 days he returns with like a deer and a boar respectively. I can't really remember offhand. But it's another one of those things that David Lowry just kind of like takes these little signposts that are in the book and expounds on them. And in much the same way that Morgan Le Fay plays a much bigger role in this, that is more significantly tied to not just Gawain's journey, but his lineage. I believe the actor who plays Morgan Le Fay in this is also the voice of the fox. And to me, the implication was that the fox serving as his familiar was the enchantress, his mother, like following along and kind of keeping track of him and sort of like making sure that he was either staying on the right path, or by the end of it, when she's like, okay, this has gone too far, like you could have learned your lesson by now, you don't have to go get your head chopped off, when she pounces in front of him and is like, don't fucking go do this, man, like, enough, this is not worth it. So that was kind of my interpretation. I know a few folks in the chat, sorry I can't shout them out directly because it's just blowing up, but a few folks also pointed that out in the chat as well.
Damn it, I wish we could keep talking about this forever, but alas, my court, it is time to bring this conversation to an end.
Alas!
If you wanna call us and you wanna contribute to this, please, you can call us at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. Leave us a voicemail. We got a couple voicemails this last week, but they were really crackly and we couldn't hear. I don't know if that was an issue with our line or your line, but please keep trying. We wanna definitely listen to those voicemails and engage with them, but we couldn't quite hear it. So definitely try to make sure that you got good reception, and then of course we'll check things on our end as well. If you don't want to call, you can email us at movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. Give us your fucking theories on Green Knight. Give us all your weird Arthurian legend tales and inside scoops and whatever else. You know, do some deep fucking rabbit hole research and let us know your thoughts, your feelings, your insight. Raymond, where can people find you on the internet before we get out of here?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria, so feel free to stop by and say hello.
Sick. Ryan?
Find me at Ryan Shorts on thy YouTube.
And you can find me on Twitter, Austin_Hayden, on Insta, AUS_HAY. That's it. Let's get out of here.
Send
Sir
us
Ryan.
That Liverpudlian goodbye, Ryan.
Farewell from Los Angeles, California. This has been Show Me Thy Meaning. Now off with our heads.